If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board while Will Erskine booking the guests in the legendary CHML newsroom. Dave Woodard here, Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. All right, a bizarre day, and we'll try to keep you up to date on it. It started with Justin Trudeau's ministers out trying to sell the budget, repeating what they've said over the last 3 weeks and over again, because it pretty much landed dead on arrival. And, you know, Canadians have kind of tuned them out. But what's happened today is quite fascinating, because Chrystia Freeland, the deputy prime minister, started talking about tabling the budget and that sort of thing. We're hearing more from the NDP on that as well. But they're going to separate the capital gains portion that came out in the budget from the actual budget. So when they vote on the budget, that's all the big stuff. And then the capital gains portion will be voted on separately, which is a fascinating political tactic. Again, trying to create a wedge issue to try to knock off the conservatives and really distract from the liberals failing in the polls and a budget that landed DOA. So it's amazing that they're going to do this, but what they're trying to do is have a separate vote on this. Now, whether they'll alter it or not, I'm not sure. Nobody knows now. So they're going to have a separate vote on this. So then they'll be able to point and say, look, the conservatives are against taxing the rich. When, as we further decode and digest the budget, as the liberals said, it was going to be all about the rich. And in fact, it's everybody who owns a family cottage to has a small business to has a doctor's office. And it's a family, physician. So this has just landed with a massive thud. So they're separating the two and then trying to point, see, the conservatives are against taxing the rich. And so that's sort of the angle, I guess, in all of this. But what happened today in the House of Commons when question period started, the prime minister stands up and he starts attacking Prime Minister, or Pierre Poilievre, rather, who's a little bit of the time, Pierre Poilievre, about his relationship with some extremist right-wing American. And, you know, calling Pierre Poilievre out because he won't stand up in the Canadian House of Commons and denounce this American. And it's just, you know, again, it's just distraction after distraction. And as we said, because the commentator said it on the news, that they're trying now to attack the conservatives because the budget hasn't resonated. So Justin lobs out this ball about, you know, being attached to this guy, this fanatic in the U.S. Then Pierre Poilievre basically comes out and says, you know, I denounce all of that sort of stuff, including prime ministers who appear in blackface or when they were young. And then so making it plainly clear that anytime you're going to play this card, he's going to play the blackface card, which, of course, is the last thing that the liberals want to see as we focus on an election whenever it happens. So it went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And it was hilarious. And then all hell broke loose. The speaker has to get involved. And at the end of the day, Pierre Poilievre gets kicked out of the House of Commons, I believe, for calling or using the word wacky. And we've got like an 8-second clip. We're finding more. But this is basically what it was about.
When will we put an end to this wacko policy by this wacko prime minister?
No.
Okay, so he calls him a wacko. Here's the actual clip of him getting kicked out.
I'm going to ask the Honorable Leader of the Opposition one last time to please withdraw that comment and simply withdraw that comment.
I simply withdraw and replace with the aforementioned adjective.
Mr. Poilievre, I have to name you for disregarding the authority of the chair.
So Pierre Poilievre would not pull back his statement about calling him a wacko. Then he said he would, and he'd replace it with extremist. And that wasn't good enough. So he asked him again, and he said he refused to, meaning Pierre Poilievre. So the Speaker of the House kicks him out. And that's where we are today. So it's fascinating to see this all unfold. You know that anytime the prime minister mentioned, keeps trying to distract with the American extremism, he's going to play the blackface card against the prime minister. And that's where we ended up today. All while nobody talks about the budget or, it's all, landed flat. So it's fascinating where this has gone. I'm not sure if this will soothe Canadians or just frustrate them even more. It's where we are. And, it was frustrating to say the least, and some may even find amusing. But at the end of the day, the session's over and, really like the next several months, not much is going to be accomplished because we have, a government that's pretty much been paralyzed. So it's fascinating to see where this will go. And there's more and more chatter. And I have a feeling there's a lot of politics at play here, but there's a lot of chatter about the prime minister stepping down. And let's be honest, if you're Pierre Poilievre, that's the last thing you want to have happen. You don't want this guy leaving and giving them any sense of hope with a new leader. So it's going to be fascinating to see how this all plays out. But it is, it's quite theatrical on every side of the house. We talked about this the other day, and, I think similar attempts have been made, whether it's, I remember way back when it was with gas stations. Let's boycott this gas station or this company and that company in order to send a message about rising prices or what have you. And we certainly know where we are with affordability now, housing, groceries, all of it, and taxes. And now certainly focus on grocers to keep prices down. There's chatter of a planned boycott of Loblaws stores. And it has, garnered a certain amount of attention from the company. And, we're going to bring in Bruce Winter on this, but is Loblaws missing an opportunity here? Because it seems whenever there's bad messaging that PR departments get behind things and quickly spin them around, it doesn't seem to be doing, not much work seems to be done in this area with this situation. And they continually paint themselves or end up being painted with, certainly not the color of brush we want. Bruce Winter with his retail analyst and author, Retail Before, During, and After COVID-19, End Here Now. Bruce, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the program.
So, Bruce, first of all, your thoughts on this. Does this work? Does it just draw attention? It's publicity more than anything. What does it do? Does it help?
Yeah, I don't think this is really going to be successful in terms of it being a boycott. I mean, it sounds like there's a very vocal sort of small minority within Canada who are really angry at Loblaw. But when you sort of peel back the onion here, you know what? It's a small fraction of Canadians. And I think that, this whole grocery thing has been used as a political football in Canada. There's just so many weird things going on. Like, why are they picking only Loblaw when you have Empire and Metro and Costco and Walmart involved too? There's just so many questions going on, but this thing has sort of taken a life of its own now.
So someone needs to be blamed, so it must be the business. So and in the way you positioned it earlier on, do you think this makes an impact? Do you think Canadians are generally mad at the grocery chains?
I think, a fraction of Canadians are, but I think some Canadians realize that it's a much more complicated discussion. I know certainly who are close to it, like myself and others, realize that there's a lot going on here. I mean, the grocery increases we saw a few years ago, that was a global phenomenon, not just in Canada. You also look at sort of, like I said, the political side of it. There's a lot going on, a lot of theatrics right now, and there's folks who think maybe this is sort of politically motivated, right? And I think if you really look at this thing, it's a bit of a smokescreen for really how I think our government can do a little more as it relates to increasing productivity and, as a result, down the road, increasing wages for Canadians. But, that's something that a lot of economists called out recently, is we have a big productivity problem. Yeah. That's probably one of the root causes with where we are right now in these kind of things.
So what's the best strategy for the grocer? Is to just back off, stay away from this, get your public CEO out of the spotlight and ride it out? Or is this an opportunity to remarket? Is this an opportunity to educate? Are the grocers missing out here, or is there nothing that they can do where that would help this? That's just, they're getting tarred and feathered and that's it.
It's a real tough one, right? Because, you know, a lot of the anger, like I mentioned, has been sort of focused on one retailer, Loblaw. But I did some digging, and it looks like what Loblaw has done is they've lowered a lot of prices too. If you look at about 35 items, you know, the basics, the milk, the breads, and things like that, they've lowered about 35 items in price about 30%. So I think they're trying to earn it back from the ground up by doing good things, you know, sort of proving it on the ice, so to speak, by doing good things. And they're trying to show that, whether it's investing in Canada, lowering prices, you know, doing a whole bunch of things to try to earn the trust, re-earn the trust of Canadians for the group that has been sort of vocal in this situation. I think most Canadians continue to trust Loblaw. I think, like I said, it's just sort of a small group, a very vocal group, who's really made an issue of it.
Obviously, there's been lots of chatter about more competition, bringing more people into the space, that sort of thing. But I've also heard from other experts that the real focus here should be on the relationship between the suppliers and the grocers and what is going on there. Can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion right now based on the grocery code of conduct. And, you know, right now, as it stands, two retailers don't feel comfortable signing it. One is Walmart. The other is Loblaw. And if you kind of put yourself in their shoes, I think what they're a little nervous about is that grocery costs are going to go up for Canadians, because some of that bargaining power they have with the big suppliers is going to be eroded or taken away based on the code of conduct. So, you know, it's a real fine line, right? You want to have an industry that's fair for everyone, but at the same time, you don't want to take away that competitive negotiation dynamic that really gets good prices for consumers too, right? So I think it's like everything in the grocery industry, it's a nuanced conversation. There's many layers to the conversation. It's never as cut and dry as we think from looking at it from the surface.
We know that it'd be very tough just with any industry, any business, any retail to compete against the larger chains. That being said, is there room for another large chain in this space?
Well, I mean, you could drop another large chain in here, but the problem with Canada is it's really costly to do business here. Like, yeah. You look at our geography, right? We've got 40 million people spread out over a massive geographic area. We've got higher taxes, higher labor costs, more regulation. We've got a lot of things that makes it really tough to make money in Canada. You know, you look at the big grocers, right? And even though they're, you know, cranking out billions a year, their profits are only low single digit net income.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? Like, and that's after having decades to get their supply chain right and everything else right. If you're a new incumbent coming in here, you'd be looking at decades of losses. So there's not a big appetite.
All right, Bruce Winder with us, retail analyst and author, Retail Before, During, and After COVID-19, the planned boycott of Loblaws. Maybe we should be focusing on other things. Bruce, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Yeah, you too. Take care. Have a great one.
We talked about this with Brian J. Karam last week, and because, you know, obviously Donald Trump, when he's anywhere, really can't keep quiet. And the judge warned him, you're going to be found in contempt if you keep babbling about things you shouldn't be babbling about. And sure enough, it looks like this has come up to bite him. Although some may question if $9,000 U.S. even makes an impact on Donald Trump. Brian J. Karam with us, journalist, author, White House correspondent for Playboy, and political analyst for CNN here now. Brian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well.
So we talked about this last week that, you know, why put these conditions in place if you're not going to enforce them? And obviously they have been. How does this make any difference? Does he just keep babbling? Does it change things in any way?
Does a brook keep babbling? Yeah. Again, is that a trick question? Donald Trump will never stop babbling. It's just going to cost him more and more. But where it's going to cost him is in the realm of public opinion, because there are people who you know, $9,000 may not be much to him. It is to other people. And it's a symbolic slap at him for being an uncontrollable, babbling moron. And so he's having to pay for the first time in his life, for the first time he's being held accountable for something. To us, it may not seem like much, but to Donald Trump, that is a slap in the face to him, and he doesn't like it. But it won't keep him from talking. He'll keep babbling.
So would this be, you know, just every time he steps out of line, ka-ching, another $1,000 or whatever? Or if you get found in contempt so many times, it changes things procedurally? Or does this, okay, at the end of the day, you got to pay the legal bill and you got to pay the contempt fees?
Well, it's not going to be like a box of Cracker Jacks. He doesn't get a surprise inside unless that surprises. It could up the ante. The judge could say, all right, look, next time you do it, it's overnight in jail. Next time you do it, it's $50,000. Next time you do it, and he can impose sanctions on, you know, during the Chicago 7, infamously, and this would happen to Donald, but they bound and gagged a guy in the courtroom. Bobby Seale, I think it was. So, I mean, they could take some very draconian stances against Donald. They won't. It'll probably be an escalation of the fine, perhaps, you know, overnight in the county lockup. But they'd have to work out a way to do that because, you know, he has around the clock Secret Service protection, and they can't negate that.
Wow. Wouldn't it be something if we got there? The more the judge does this, the more publicity it generates for Donald Trump. Is that a good thing? Or do voters realize, you know, no matter what side of the debate you're on here, you've still got to respect the institution?
Some people are going to follow him into the depths of hell and will camp next to him and love the warmth. But there are those increasingly... There are a number of people increasingly becoming disavowing themselves from Donald Trump for the simple fact of the matter that you can only take so much childlike baloney before you just go, look, child, grow up. I mean, most adults recognize the behavior of Donald Trump as a spoiled brat. Some of them have raised spoiled brats. So they recognize what they're looking at, the animal that they're looking at. And some people are becoming, you know, upset with him. But we'll have to see. It's still, he still leads in the polls, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Did he react to this? How did he react to this?
Well, I would love to know how he reacted privately to this. Publicly, Donald Trump is all about reacting in public to generate more publicity for himself. But privately, I'd like to know what his attorneys said to him and what he said to them. I think that's more telling. There are reports that he's upset with his attorney. There are reports that he's acted even more childish privately than publicly. And that's from people who are far closer to him than I would ever want to be, care to be, or have been. So I'll let them speak to that.
What will his attorneys try to say to him? Will they try to obviously do what they're supposed to do and advise?
It's going to be two words.
Can he keep running through lawyers and just keep firing and hiring and firing and hiring?
Well,
and
he has for a lifetime.
Yeah.
There's always some fool that will. I mean, he doesn't pay his attorneys. I guess they do it for the notoriety. He's a notorious non-payer. So it would be interesting to see what they're not going to leave him during the middle of the trial. That would be very rare for an attorney to leave during the middle of a trial. If they do, it's got to be for cause and not just because he's an idiot.
So this, in your mind, will fuel the fire. The next time he's in front of a microphone, he's going to babble about this.
Oh, God, yes. Well, and anything else that he wants to babble about. He's going to babble about Biden. He's going to babble about immigration. He's going to babble about what he had for breakfast. I mean, Donald Trump is nothing if he's got diarrhea of the mouth and he can't stop himself. And that's just the way he is and who he is. I think what's more frightening is how demented his babbling has become.
Yeah.
We like to make fun of Joe Biden's mental acumen, but Donald Trump is the one that really looks like he's about two steps away from falling off the cliff. and we're going to end up, you know, weakened at Bernie's if he gets reelected.
Does this end up in Donald Trump generating more revenue? In other words, like he gets fined $9,000. Does he make that in, you know, in a half an hour? Does he raise that again?
Well, let's see, $9,000. He's got to sell what, 150 Bibles to take care of that.
So, yeah, once again, Brian, I've realized I've asked a dumb question. Oh, man. So, will there be another product line coming out? Here seems a more common question. Will there be another product line of something coming out to help pay for all of this? Is there something in addition to the Bible?
Underwear.
There you go. All right. Brian J. Karam with us.
What can I tell you? He'll sell anything that he can. But the key, Scott, to realize is that he's behind in fundraising. And most of his money is going to his legal squabble. And that's where he's in trouble. And that doesn't show in the polls right now. But after the conventions, it may start to have a deleterious effect on his supposed candidacy.
Brian J. Karam with us, journalist, author, White House correspondent for Playboy, political analyst for CNN. Donald Trump found in contempt of court, but chances are that won't silent much. Brian, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott. And don't buy any Trump underwear.
I won't. No, I'm going to leave it at that. I'm not even biting on that, Brian, and that's a bad choice of words right there. All right, you take care. You did. I mean, there it is, out of the park. All right. We talk about this a lot, trying to gauge where the minds of Canadians are. This from the RBC Bank. It's the 30th annual home ownership poll that the bank does, and their new polling shows that 60% of Ontario residents believe they will need a second job or a side hustle to afford a home in this province. To talk more about all of this, Don Fox is with us, executive financial consultant, Fox Group, IG Private Wealth Management. And of course, you can hear Planning Your Financial Future every Saturday morning. Don, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Doing great, Scott. Yourself?
So far, so good. So, Don, are you hearing this anecdotally more and more that people are trying to do and you know, at least look for a side hustle or an extra part-time job or something just to make ends meet or even to afford a mortgage?
You know what? Not just a new house, but actually even to keep their existing house, considering these mortgages are coming up for renewal. And they've gone from, say, a 2% rate to about a 5% rate. And this has put a lot of strain on those, you know, COVID home buyers that locked in for, you know, a 3-year or 4-year mortgage, and they're all coming due right now. So, yes, absolutely. This is I have heard about this.
And, you know, you can certainly see people who are trying to make ends meet once they're in a situation. But, boy, is this the way to start on your home ownership plan?
Well, it's probably not the best way to start. Don't know about you, Scott, but it wasn't easy for us to get homes back in the day.
Yeah, very true. Mm-hmm.
You know, it meant we didn't go out for dinner. You had one car. You did what you had to do just to be able to afford the house. And again, you look back at days gone by, a 10% mortgage. You got the Trudeau countdown going on here, Scott. And we didn't even have an under 10% countdown because we never thought rates would ever get under 10%.
Yeah, it's more like what our parents were paying way back when, and even less than them.
Yeah, 100%. That was always, well, that was back in the 50s or 60s, and they had like 5 or 6% mortgages. Now we're complaining that we have a 5 or 6% mortgage. Yes, albeit the home prices went up dramatically because the rates had dropped. And so these people...
And also a short supply, right? Short supply driving prices through the roof.
Well... 100%, you know, and I know you've alluded to this on your talk show, and immigration policies don't help. Yeah. So, you know, you end up with a lot of immigrants looking for a home, and we don't have the supply. And even what they try to forecast would be very difficult to achieve. So it's a tough spot to be in. And Ontario is definitely one of the hardest hit with the home prices. Vancouver's not much better, to be honest.
The middle class dream, buy your house, buy your house, whatever, maybe upgrade, get bigger ones somewhere down the line, what have you, sell, there's your estate, and that's how you generate wealth over a period of time. And that's the way it's been for a really long time. We're obviously hearing about the generation that may not have what their parents have, the loss of the middle class dream, that being the ability for the average middle class person to even get started in a home. Did you ever think we would get here? Did you ever think, you know, or be surprised that, wow, we've got to the point where, you know, middle class young people can't buy a house?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It's ironic that we're talking about middle class is worse off now. And yeah. Considering that's what the politics has been talking about for the last 8 years about how to improve the middle class, right? And it's actually, you're absolutely right, it is a little worse. And home purchase has always been the recipe of how to at least create that one layer of peace of mind, if not part of your retirement plan, is you own a house, pay it off, and at least you own this big asset that would perhaps fund your retirement if need be. But it was always there, like almost a security blanket. So it's not the only way. In North America, it's kind of been the absolutely the norm to do that. Certainly Europe has not been the norm. But here in North America, that has been the recipe. And there is other ways. You can rent. You can save. It takes more discipline. There's nothing that gives more discipline than having to make a mortgage payment. That bank really wants their payment. So therefore, we are forced to make that payment. And the house gets paid off. And that is a great way. And you get appreciation on the home. And you got, you know, and you build memories. And there's more to it than simply an asset. So, yeah, I did not personally see this coming. Other than we did see a lot of parents help out millennials in the last little while of purchasing their first house.
I don't know if you've got wind of this, but this is literally just breaking news that Chrystia Freeland has announced that the capital gains issue will not be a part of this budget voted on, that it will be in a separate motion and the capital gains tax will be voted on by itself. And they're hoping the reason being for that, although she didn't say this, was to create a wedge issue with the conservatives and point C, they're not going to vote for taxing the rich. So obviously where this puts the deadline of June 25th, I'm not sure, but it looks like this is starting to get a little cloudy now.
Huh. Interesting. Oh, also it allows the NDP to vote against one and for the other and keep them in power too. So
interesting point. It's always evolving. And we'll talk about this more. All right. Don Fox with his executive financial consultant with the Fox Group, IG Private Wealth Management. Need a side hustle to afford a home? Don, thanks for the time. Be well.
Anytime, Scott. Thanks again for calling.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
All right, we certainly know in the conflict involving Ukraine and Russia with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and how that supposed to be a short operation has just dragged out and dragged out. Issues with getting aid to Ukraine and from the U.S., the money needed to continue to move forward and at least, you know, keep the Russians at bay. And discussion about when that's coming, how it's going to arrive, and all everyday Ukraine just trying to hang on. And now a North Korean missile landed in Ukraine after seemingly being launched from the territory of the Russian Federation, and it seems like it was procured from North Korea, which goes against regulation. Elliot Tepper with us, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University, and here now. Elliot, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Oh, thank you. Same to you, Scott.
So what does this mean, having found this this shell from North Korea in Ukraine? What does this say? What do we learn from this?
Well, the very first thing we learn is that Russia is continuing its totally illegal aggression against Ukraine and that we should not normalize it. They've been launching massive missile attacks using basically every type of weapon they have almost in their arsenal, apart from nuclear. So Ukraine is under attack by Russia. The second thing now is we have to add in it's doing so with North Korean banned military assistance. Russia has, you know, some problems with sourcing around the world, they don't have their own productive capacity up. So what we have now is they've reached out to North Korea pretty clearly. And this is a banned military operation. You're not supposed to be dealing with North Korea. Last September, Mr. Putin received Kim Jong-un in Moscow, or not in Moscow, in Russia, and they clearly made a deal. There's been huge shipments of not just missiles, but also, very critically, ammunition has been provided by North Korea. And as we know, that ammunition, as well as these missiles, are being used with great effect, unfortunately, against.
Where and how does North Korea get all this? Are they producing this? And yes, and how big of a source are they?
Oh, they're a major source now. Apparently, 10 major containers of artillery shells alone. They've got Soviet era artillery type shells, and which is what Russia is using. So the attacks on Ukraine, which is outnumbering, as we know, because of the delayed assistance to Ukraine from the U.S., outnumbering them now is something like 10 to 1. A lot of that is with imported artillery shells and now these missiles. The additional element in all this is, it doesn't get any attention, Scott. Russia has also imported, again, quite contrary to U.N. resolutions, specific resolutions, labor. North Korea sends its workers abroad. North Korea, of course, is desperately poor, and they need the money. And this has been going on for some time, in the thousands most recently. Scott, these laborers are being sent to the Donbass to help on construction work there. So what we see here, in short, is that there's a growing alignment, this what used to be called the Axis of Evil, but we also have now newer terms of, I don't know, Axis of Autocrats, is tightening. We know right now that North Korea also has just sent a delegation to Tehran.
So how does this change the worldview of North Korea?
I think it just reminds us, and North Korea doesn't like to be out of the spotlight by and large. If you ignore them very long, they do something egregious. But in this case, they would like to be out of the spotlight. And it's our job to keep them in the spotlight, that they are an integral part of the growing nexus, the increasingly durable and multifunctional nexus between China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. North Korea, as you know, also has missiles, and they are already a nuclear weapon state. I'm very concerned, of course, when anybody goes to Tehran and says, we can help you out, and they're already a nuclear weapon state. That includes Russia, of course.
How do others who are supporting Russia view this support from North Korea? Go ahead.
Well, the chief sponsor there would be China. And that's always a very delicate and interesting question, because North Korea has basically tried to loosen their total dependence on China, and they are almost totally dependent on China, which is apparently and reportedly violating UN sanctions to assist North Korea, providing them coal and other items, and also exporting we don't know what. But Russia looms up, and North Korea says, look, we'll deal with them as well. And they try subtly to play off Russia and China. But in fact, this is not so much a competition, but a cooperation effort among those autocratic regimes. And now adding in again, Iran, where the drones, among other things, are being manufactured. Those lethal drones by Iran are being manufactured now inside Russia with Iranian support.
Obviously, we've only got a few seconds left, Elliot, but this has been dragging on for an awfully long time. Is this expanding, this war?
No, it's sustaining the war. Russia hopes to take advantage of the temporary lapse in support for Ukraine, which is now being rectified, to push their advantage to make a decisive change. Ukraine has fought that off valiantly so far, but they now need our support, which they are getting increasingly, in order to sustain the effort to stop the imperial ambitions of Russia working with these autocratic regimes, which are all opposed to the West, including us.
Elliot Tepper with us, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University. North Korean missile lands in Ukraine, launched from territory of the Russian Federation. Elliot, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you. Same to you, Scott.
A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Now, we all remember, it seems like years ago now, when the Globe and Mail and Global News broke a story about Chinese interference in the last two federal elections, and the Prime Minister just playing dumb to the whole thing. Nobody told me. I didn't know anything about it, and blamed everybody else except his office. And then, of course, we find out that CSIS did, in fact, deliver the information up the chain. It's just, for some reason, it doesn't get from the Prime Minister secretary to actually him for some strange reason. Well, now the FBI is having the exact same problem. They warned that Canadian MPs and senators were being targeted for hacking by agents of the Chinese government back in 2021, but that information did not affect or reach the affected members of the Canadian government until recently. So in other words, it was the FBI that had to tell these MPs about the threats from the Chinese Communist Party rather than their own government. Who knew what? And are we to expect that they would know anything about this when they didn't know anything about what we were talking earlier? Phil Gersey with us, president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, former CSIS analyst, and here now. Phil, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
I am, Scott.
So is this, Phil, the exact same sort of scenario, just different from what we were talking about and started this discussion way back when the information is just not getting fed up the line of command? Here we have the FBI warning the Canadian government about Canadian MPs and senators that are being targeted, and they're not getting the information.
It does seem we've been talking about this for eons, Scott. This is interesting in that obviously the Bureau, the FBI, has been monitoring the situation. I'm sure that there are American representatives as well that have been targeted by the Chinese. And we have a very good relationship with the FBI, both CSIS and the RCMP, sharing information back and forth all the time. The fact that the FBI appears to actually briefed MPs on this, I find really interesting. The way it normally works is that information is shared with CSIS and the RCMP, which is authorized to share it with the government itself. But we're getting the story that, well, you know, for national security reasons, which is ironic, given the government doesn't care about national security, we couldn't share it with MPs themselves. There are some glitches in the system, Scott, but there's no doubt in my mind this information should have been shared in a way that didn't compromise sources with the MPs affected.
Many are questioning the relationship the government has with CSIS because it seems at times the government will throw CSIS under the bus, or there's some sort of lack of communication or some sort of wall that's up. What's the relationship like between the FBI and the Canadian government? Is it any different?
Great question. As I said, I know it's really good between CSIS and the FBI. I certainly saw that in my 15 years working in counterterrorism. I dealt an awful lot with the FBI and made some really good friends in the FBI. I would hope that the government, I mean, you know, they could say, well, CSIS, you're kind of a second-rate organization. This is the government talking, not me. I just want to make clear here. Maybe the FBI is more credible. Maybe they're better. So if they're ignoring the FBI information, who are they going to ignore next? I mean, if the Brits tell us something, or the Australians, or Lord knows whom, what will it take for this government to take intelligence and information on espionage and technology threats or theft seriously?
And again, going back to the first situation with all of this, way back when with the Globe and Global News, Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc seems to be very vague on all of this. What, again, asking the questions of what each person knew and when.
They've been vague on everything, Scott. And this is what really ticks me off as a former CSIS analyst is, look at, we provided you the information going back at least a decade and a half, okay? Successive governments, but some of the officials have been in the business for quite some time. Can you please just level with Canadians about what you knew, when you knew it, who told you to the extent you can, and what you did with the information rather than, and you've made the point, you know, the Prime Minister is pointing fingers everywhere except back at himself or his you know, his office kind of thing. I think Canadians deserve to know why it is that this really solid intelligence that affected a whole bunch of things from our elections to our technology to harassment of, you know, anti-Chinese dissidents here in Canada, why this was not acted upon. But I'll tell you, I'm not betting the mortgage, if I had one, that this is going to happen anytime soon. They're going to obfuscate and deflect the question time and time again.
Obviously, as many have pointed out, this is going on with other countries, including the United States, who are obviously taking action against this. How does that change Canada's stance on all of this? I mean, how can the United States be viewing this ignoring of this FBI information?
Well, this is the crux of the problem is that, and you and I have talked about this before, Scott, our allies are asking some very uncomfortable questions about the current government in terms of what it thinks of national security and public safety, what it thinks of the use of intelligence. And I think they're asking the right questions is that can, in fact, we be trusted? And we've talked about the Five Eyes and the sharing of intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. But if you've got a major partner like the United States who starts wondering whether or not Canada really should be part of this club, and I'm not saying we're going to be get cut off tomorrow, no. But I think that they've got some really legitimate questions about, you know, do we take this stuff seriously? And are we part of the same team here, the part of the Western team? I just hope at some point someone wakes up and smells the coffee or Chinese tea or green tea or whatever and begins to realize just what kind of a threat this poses to us here in Canada.
Do you see another inquiry into this, Phil?
Oh, God, please, no. No more inquiries.
Exactly. Where does this go?
Well, as I've said before, you know, we do national inquiries as often as we watch NHL hockey playoff games. I think, you know, inquiries, they look good. They're sexy. They're out there. And let's face it, you and I both learned a lot, I think, from the public inquiry on foreign interference. So that's a good thing. But the problem is that what's the aftermath? What's the outcome? You have an inquiry that makes 147 recommendations. How many recommendations get followed up on? Or is it just, you know, gather dust on a file somewhere or on someone's thumb drive? That's why I don't like inquiries. I think it's all show and little action. So please, please, no more inquiries. Let's just get things done.
So what about these politicians, MPs, senators that have been targeted? What sort of recourse do they have? What do they do moving forward?
That's another great question. I would hope that they would seek advice from CSC, so Communications Security Establishment, which is our cyber, you know, experts here in Canada, and from the service and from the RCMP on how to protect their own communications better, how to act in a way that doesn't allow them to be open to Chinese infiltration. So they can take action on their own. But you would think that in a country like Canada, there'd be directives from the, you know, the highest point in the country saying, we're aware of this action. Our intelligence agencies have told us this. Here's what you need to do to be better protect yourself against the possibility of China interfering in your activities. That's what we don't seem to have gotten, unless, you know, maybe CSC has advised these people separately. But, you know, if an individual MP has to start looking for things that he or she can do to be better off, that's a bad scenario. That directive should be coming from the highest level and should be shared with all MPs so that we're all singing from the same song sheet.
Phil Gursky with us, president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, former CSIS analyst. FBI warning Canadian MPs and senators targeted by agents of the Chinese government. However, that information never got from the Canadian government to them. Phil, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
You too, sir. We'll talk soon.
Let's bring in Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert. Justin Trudeau showing up on podcasts and pitching his message to Americans. That and the general message. Let's bring in Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert. Alyssa, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I am. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
We talked a long time ago about the Prime Minister getting a new comms person, and over they've said that the message is not resonating, it's not getting to the people. We haven't been doing a good enough job of explaining our policy to the voters. That's why they don't get it. They don't understand it. Took 3 weeks to bring out a budget virtually every day, another $1 billion, another announcement. You can't say we don't get the message now. We've all heard it loud and clear, and it arrives DOA. It hasn't moved the numbers at all. Now we're seeing the strategy move to attacking Pierre Poilievre and comparing him to U.S. extremists and this sort of thing. Let's start with the budget. Can we use the excuse anymore that people just don't understand the policy? We're hearing it loud and clear now.
You know, I think people do understand the policy, but it's interesting because I've heard actually some very good things about the new comms person who's running the show over in the Prime Minister's office. And I think that when you don't have a strategy that seems to be landing with your targeted audience, then you have to pivot. And what a lot of political parties don't do well is pivot. They kind of like to go in the straight line, and they kind of like to do what they know best. So that is stay with Canadian media, stay with mainstream media, and hope that your story lands, as well as doing your own thing on social. And I have seen them hammering away on social. Certain ministers, you know, they'll always parrot the party line, so you see that. However, let's remember that media today is not necessarily confined within Canadian borders. You know, 25, 30 years ago, when you wanted the news, you got the news from your Canadian sources. Now you can get news from anywhere. So by using a strategy where you go across the border and you go into a podcast, which can be listened to by anybody, anywhere, you are broadening your reach. And perhaps in this case, broadening your reach, not only about your message, but also to your target audience, which may be aligned with that particular podcast. Because these are borderless. Podcasts are borderless. You can listen to something from Japan if you wanted. So by broadening the scope of their media opportunities. So for example, Scott, do you think that a president of the United States would have ever sat down with Howard Stern in the last 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? No. But Joe Biden, President Joe Biden, just sat down with Stern the other day. So the tried and true and willing to push the envelope a little bit seems to be the order of the day when we're talking about getting the message out.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, 100%, but I think the message has been heard loud and clear. And I think even coming from an American source, I think we're smart enough to understand the message, is the same. Moving forward. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead. But I would say sometimes when you hear a message from a source that isn't an expected one, you listen better because Canadians are always interested to hear what Americans say about us. So I think that played in part of the strategy. Okay.
All right. Let's today. It gets ugly in the House of Commons.
It
got wacko, and both sides are throwing back and forth. And eventually the leader of the opposition says, when will we put an end to this wacko policy? From this wacko prime minister, asked to replace that word, he did with extremist or radical, and that's not going to cut it either. Long story short, gets turfed out. Where do you go with this? I mean, can you keep trying to distract? I mean, it is what it is. Where do you see the messaging in all of this?
Well, let's just remember that no politician says anything unless it's been premeditated and vetted by their office.
So yes.
The fact that Polyev came out with the wacko policy, wacko prime minister, I think he used the word wacko four times.
So do you think he was trying to get kicked out?
Absolutely. Yeah. That is absolutely the strategy. Not only did he try to get kicked out, he succeeded. And not only did they think that this would go over all the airwaves, thinking that the least of their problems is that Polyev got kicked out, even though they knew that would lead the headline. What they tried to achieve was the fact that they think his strategy out in BC about decriminalizing drugs is wacko.
Yeah.
And if you are the average news person who is basically just, you know, listening, you know, with half an ear or flipping by on your social platforms, what you're going to get is Polyev kicked out of Commons for calling PM wacko.
Bingo. We've already made it into an ID. So let me ask you this. Okay. So I thought this earlier on in the day, this has all been planned. And here's my thought behind it. You tell me what you think. I think the Liberals are really close to getting a new leader. I think because the poop's hit the fan. I think that is the last thing that Pierre Polyev wants. He wants to take this and Justin Trudeau all the way to the very end, because even if they change leaders, there's a slight chance they could get a bump out of this. So do you think this has anything to do with the fact that they want him to stay in?
You know, I don't know. I mean, honestly. Yeah, you can play the long game on this. Do I think that they're playing the long game? No. I think that in cases like this, especially in politics, you play the game sometime that's here and now. Yeah, it could feed into the long game, sure. And I agree with you. The worst thing that could happen is that the Liberals change leaders right now.
Yeah.
Whether Justin Trudeau's ego will allow that, I'm not sure. But you know, most of the time you're playing the here and now. What are the clips? What's coming up in question period? How can we capitalize it? How can we take over the news cycle? Okay, that's done. What are we doing tomorrow? So yes, you have short-term goals. Yes, you have long-term goals, but there's no more, there's, you know, you can have as much joy as you want in seeing the fruits of your effort appear right in front of your eyes on the website when the headline that you had in your head as a communications professional appears on every single news daily.
Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert. She's no wacko. Alyssa, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Okay, I'll take that, Scott.
That's a compliment. Honestly, it was a compliment, although it was a clumsy. It's a clumsy.
That's okay.
It's a clumsy one, but I apologize. Thank you, Alyssa.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
All right, Ontario Education Minister Stephen Lecce is going to join us, talk about the updating rules around cell phones and vaping in the province's schools. We talked about this for a while and getting phones out of the classrooms. I'm sorry, I don't think it's that hard of a deal than what people are making it out to be. I find a cell phone a great disciplinary tool for my kids. Don't do what I say, give me the phone. End of story. I'm not sure why this is an issue, but obviously there's guidelines in place now. Stephen Lecce, Minister of Education, Province of Ontario, here now. Stephen, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Thanks so much, Scott.
All right. Whenever you bring something like this up, some people will say, well, they need it for this. They need it for that. How are you going to do this? I don't know. Thank goodness you finally come out with some guidelines here and to help educators, I guess. But how is this all going to work, Stephen? How are teachers going to enforce this in the classroom?
Well, the first principle is the default in September for our kids is cell phones are out of sight and out of mind. We need to change the culture in our schools. We have compelling data points, Scott. I mean, more than half of our kids are not meeting the provincial math standards, and we've got compelling mental health data that we've never had higher rates of addictions when it comes to vaping, when it comes to dependence on technology, with kids spending 5 hours plus a day on electronic devices. It's clear. The status quo is not working. So yes, the province is bringing forth a robust, comprehensive plan to crack down on vaping and to restrict cell phones, not ban them, but restrict them responsible use of technology. So the question, how do you do it? You said, you know, I don't think it's that difficult. If you just have to establish some leadership and clarity and conviction in the policy and how you enforce it, it can be done. Parents do it all the time. Some schools in this province, because of strength and the courage of principals to get the buy-in of their parents, have this policy in place. The problem is it's like a small minority. We need to be the standard in Ontario. So the policy is for children, kindergarten to grade six, the now requirement is you will be required to keep your cell phone out of sight the entire day because you're in the classroom and there's no reason for that young child to have access to the phone through the day. If a teacher needs to give permission for a lunch for them to use it, if that's the expectation of the home, teachers will use discretion. It's built into the policy. We're going to be reasonable, but we're trying to set a signal. When you're in class and you're a young kid, grade three, grade four, grade five, focus on the teacher. There is no reason why you have a cell phone in the classroom and you won't be allowed. It has to be turned off or on silent, away from the child, stored out of sight. For the older kids, the middle school kids, 7 and 8, and then of course, high school kids, for them, it's about trying to model behavior and teach them appropriate use of technology. So we're not banning it because bans have almost never worked. But there are ways by which we come up with the responsible use of the tech. So when you're sitting in your chair, thumbs in a seat, and you're in front of your teacher during instructional time, our expectation is that there will not be access to technology unless the teacher explicitly permits it. If it's for educational purposes, wonderful. Sometimes, Scott, as I said to you before, you need technology to learn. So there'll be times where they're going to actually encourage you to take out your laptop or your iPad or a phone or whatever it is. But for the majority of the time, teachers are going to say, take your cell phones away. No need for technology in the class. And if they see a child is continuing to violate the policy, they're on TikTok and there's noise and they're distracting, they now have the explicit authority to use progressive discipline powers. First principle is they can ask the student to bring the phone up, put on the front desk, turn it off, and it sits there for that class, not for the day, for the class. The student would then retrieve their phone and have access to it again. It would have been on their person the whole time if they followed the rules. So this is a reaction to their decision to violate that policy. But the point is, we have that policy, we have that power, and now they can send them to the principal's office and go all the way up to, if absolutely necessary, a suspension. Not the intent, but you have to have teeth, because the lesson learned from teachers said to me, look, we love the concept of cracking down on distraction, but you've got to have our backs and you've got to give me an enforcement tool. So no one did this in the past. No board wanted to touch this because it was a headache and it was annoying. But what I'm sort of saying is, we've built this policy from the bottom up, listening to the voices of parents and students and medical experts and staff, but it will be imposed from the top down. We need discipline back into our classroom.
Yeah, and it seemed odd, and I want to get on to vaping really quick because we don't have much time, but it seemed odd that some school boards are suing social media companies when, in fact, we're not dealing with the issue right in the actual classroom itself, but we'll save that. Vaping, yeah. I'm guessing, very similar to smoking, not allowed. Update us on this.
Well, I mean, just and it's 2 seconds on the last point. We're also banning social media sites from school Wi-Fi and devices, which every school board who's launched litigation could have done. They could have done something about it instead of litigating the biggest companies on earth. But that was their choice, and we choose to act to actually limit, to create responsible limitations of technology and social media, which are amplifying bullying, trafficking, so many concerns. And so that's why we're acting today. That'll be in effect for September. On vaping, it's actually a much more absolute policy. Cell phones have that all bit of discretion. We're going to respect teacher judgment, and we're going to back their judgment every time they implement enforcement. But on vaping, like as a first principle, Scott, it is illegal to own a vape if you're a student in Ontario under 18. Mm. What are you doing with cannabis and tobacco and these tobacco nicotine pouches? And it is illegal. So it is, first off, immoral that we're normalizing smoking of young children at their developmental stage. So we need to be totally zero tolerant, like an absolute policy. It will be unambiguously enforced. You're caught smoking or vaping or using cannabis, the expectation now is the parent is immediately called. That we don't do that in Ontario. Some do. I would argue a small minority do. We now will require this using provincial authority. So there's no discretion. Parents engage, the device is taken away, and of course, discipline can be invoked, as well as public health agencies could be brought in. That it could even include for enforcement and for education. So it's a much stronger policy to say there is no room for vaping and cannabis. We have the highest rates on earth in Canada. I'm deeply concerned about it. I want to believe we all think we have to tackle the problem, and we're bringing forth a plan, of course, supported by the Chief Medical Officer of Health and consulted SickKids. We had CAMH stand with us, the senior vice president, the chief scientist of CAMH, stand at the announcement saying, like, finally, governments are doing what's right. They're tackling this issue head on. They're using education upstream to prevent it, but they're also going to enforce it. And we're going to put $30 million of vape detectors in washrooms, because right now, if you walked into a washroom in Hamilton, you would smell vape in the restroom, boys and girls. And that's not right. It's become a safe place for vaping. It's become a place of bullying. Some kids don't even go to the restroom because they feel intimidated. Like, what is going on? So, yes, we need enforcement. We need discipline. We need rigor. And I want staff to know I have their backs. We will totally support them from the top down as they implement this. And I need parents to play a role in speaking to their kids to help, frankly, reimagine how they learn. Because if we do so, we could have a generational impact on their mental health, physical health, and academic success. That's what it's about.
Stephen Lecce with us, Minister of Education, Province of Ontario. Cell phone rules and vaping, new and details finally laid out for school boards. Stephen, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Thank you.
Well, obviously the budget came down on the 16th, about 3 weeks of preamble before that, and every day something new announced as the Liberals were trying to explain to us all what exactly was going on. Part of that was a tax on capital gains, which was supposed to be focused on just the rich. However, it affects everybody from who owns a family cottage to a small business person to a doctor with their own practice. So now Chrystia Freeland, Deputy Prime Minister, has announced today that the omnibus budget bill will not include the capital gains portion. That will be left out, and that will be a separate motion to be voted on later separately. And the hoping here is that this will create another wedge issue for the Liberals against the Conservatives, and the Liberals can say, look, these guys are against taxing the rich. It's very odd. Not sure where this goes moving forward. Dr. Ian Lee is with us, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. Ian, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Doing well, thanks, Scott.
So how do you package this, Ian? Obviously, they're separating it from the actual budget. Why, right, do you think?
Well, I think what you said is correct. The Globe has reported on this based on leaks from the finance ministry that they did want to have a separate up-down vote on the capital gains tax. Of course, this was a decision made by the government because they control the votes in parliament. And so they want the source said they want to flush out the Conservatives and have them vote on this yay or nay. And, I think there's a lot of politics here. I mean, having said that, and I'm not here at all to defend Ms. Freeland or the budget, I was very critical of the capital gains tax because of the gap it's created between Canada and the United States. I don't think that's a good thing, given that they're already drawing in all kinds of foreign capital around the world, goes into the States, including attracting capital from Canada. So that's not a good thing, but that's not about what I think. It's whether this was a good thing or not. Omnibus bills have been criticized by both parties for as long as I can remember. Harper government criticized it, not Harper party criticized it when they were in opposition. Liberals criticized it. It's really annoying to a lot of people who believe in transparency and good government, because an omnibus bill involves putting just a whole pile of things into one bill rather than having separate votes on separate major policy issues. So I don't think it's actually a bad thing that they're separating the capital gains bill because it's so major in and of itself. And secondly, you know, politics is about making choices, and we've all got to make choices. And I mean, every political party needs to make choices to tell voters where they stand. And sometimes you have to take unpopular positions.
Do you think that this will matter in the long, in the grand scheme of things? And by that, I mean, it seems that of all the things to pull out of this and debate separately, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, because we'll certainly find out where everybody stands on all of this.
Yes.
But I'm not sure, again, this goes back to the earlier Liberal charge that people just aren't understanding what it is that we're trying to do. I'm not sure doing all of this will work in their favor. I'm not sure that spending more time investigating this is going to change people's minds. What are your thoughts?
Scott, I'll agree with you, but I'm going to go further than that. I do agree, but we'll go further, meaning this could backfire on the Liberals.
Yeah.
How so? They have said over and over and over, don't worry, everybody. This is only going to hit a tiny, tiny, tiny number of Canadians, the richest of the richest of the rich, 0.13% of Canadians. They've said that over and over. And now we know there's all kinds of people coming out of the woodwork, left, right, and center, saying, wait a minute, this is going to hit my cottage and I'm not rich. And doctors are complaining, and we're finding more and more people in the famous proverbial middle class are getting hit by this tax. I mean, when she first announced it in the House of Commons on Budget Day, because I'm a former banker and I financed in my time, I financed an awful lot of cottages, let me tell you. Believe you me, I financed just a ton of secondary homes in Eastern Ontario and West Quebec, where there's thousands of lakes and very lovely cottages and so forth. And I thought, you know, you're playing with fire there, Ms. Freeland, because there's an awful lot of ordinary Canadians who are not billionaires and multi-gazillionaires who have, you know, a cottage that they was passed down from the grandparents to the parents to the grandchildren and so on. And they go up in value over time, and they're going to get hit by that capital gains. You know, a dentist selling off a practice when they retire, doctors and so forth. So this could blow back. Because if they hold hearings in the House of Commons Finance Committee, I'm sure the Conservatives are going to bring in all kinds of ordinary people telling the liberals how they, the liberal policy, is beating up these ordinary people. So I can see this potentially blowing back against them and undermining what they're trying to do.
I agree with you because this draws more attention to the details that the liberals have ignored. They're selling this as it's only taxing the rich. As you break it down and peel back the layers of the onion, you find, no, it's also affecting the middle class. So I'm not sure if this will work in the sense that this will make people question it even more and realize it's not necessarily as promised.
In fact, I think that I would assume, and I'm not in the back room, but I've lived in Ottawa all my life, and I certainly know people that work in the back rooms of both parties, by the way, Liberal and Conservative, and I'm sure there's people there doing their so-called oppo research. That's the big in Ottawa slang term. Oppo research is opposition research. And I'm sure that they're going to try and generate a list of names of people across Canada, middle class, ordinary people who are going to get hit by this. Not just doctors, but people that own, they've inherited a small farm from granddad, you know, that sort of thing. And I'm sure that they'll want to bring them all as witnesses. Because every bill is examined, or the major financial bills are examined by the Finance Committee, and they do call witnesses. I've appeared there many times before the Finance Committee, as recently as only 2 weeks ago, and so they're going to bring in people who are going to be hit by this, and they're going to tell tales of woe, saying, "Look, I'm just a teacher, or I'm just an ordinary guy." Person, and I think they're going to do their best. The Conservatives are going to do their best to embarrass the Liberals, and they may rue the day yet that they decided to hive off this bill and call for separate hearings on it, because it is going to hit. I mean, that's the Canadian dream, the famous Canadian cottage, you know, summer at the lake. And I never owned a second property, but I have a ton of friends and ordinary middle-class people who have a cottage, you know, and they bought it years and years and years ago for literally $50,000 or $100,000, maybe 30 years ago. But the thing has gone up, as we all know, they've all gone up in value. So I think there's hundreds of thousands, if not several million Canadians that are going to be affected by this capital gains tax on a second property.
All right. Dr. Ian Lee with us, associate professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. Chrystia Freeland going to have the capital gains portion of the budget in a separate motion. Ian, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
Whack-a policy.
What is that?
Hamilton's News, today's talk.
900 CHML.
That's whack, yo. Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, I hope you're having a great day.
Well, I'm not going to call you a wacko because I don't want to get sent home and not be able to do my show. I'll tell you that.
Call me a wacko. I think it's great. You know what's hilarious? Major Tom's already taken the phrase wacko. We put it into an ID. All you're going to be hearing for the next 24-hour news cycle is Pierre Poilievre calling Justin Trudeau a wacko prime minister. And I'm not sure many Canadians disagree with that.
So here's the question that I do have about this. And like, you know, there's going to be a million jokes and a million comments. But the other day, the prime minister said that Poilievre was courting white nationalist groups, which is essentially saying he is a racist white nationalist guy, and that's okay.
That's what started this in the House of Commons, and then as soon as Trudeau played that card, Poilievre played the blackface card, and then it just spiraled out of control.
But again, to me, accusing someone of white nationalism and being a racist is more offensive than saying someone is a wacko, which we've all called someone in our life for various reasons. I don't understand where the guidebook is that says, okay, here's the word you can, here's the words you can. Yeah. Now, there are some words, understandably, that I don't think it requires much imagination that we know we can't use or they can't use. And good, you know, that's fine. We all know what those are. But then you get into this gray area, and here's the thing that, yeah, Scott, the thing that came to mind was when Andrea Horvath used her strong mayor powers, I said at the time, it's a dangerous thing that she's done in some ways, because now anytime something comes up, people are going to say, but what about that? You got to use them there. Now, the Speaker of the House, anytime someone says anything now, he's going to have all these parties screaming and yelling, going, hey, what about that? That's like wacko. And so now, you know, now rather, I think, than settling this whole thing down, he's probably just lit a fuse that we're now going to have a million screaming matches about what's an acceptable word or not to use in the House.
And considering we've had S-bombs and F-bombs in the House.
That didn't get people kicked out.
It didn't get in there, but wacko does. And we're already seeing this on social media where people are now questioning the speaker and his loyalties, which, you know, here we go again around and around. You know, you go to the extreme, it pushes those in the center to the opposite extreme. Here we go.
It's, it is, as I say, I would bet you that by the next sitting of the House, there will be screaming matches because someone will say something that they will then demand that this be the equivalent of wacko that gets someone kicked out. It's just, it's inevitable now. This is going to turn into childish games about what word is allowed and what word isn't allowed. And honestly, Scott, like, really, if you were the prime minister, is wacko a word that really digs so deeply at the core of your being that you would think this is the line?
No, blackface would be. And again, you know, I said this earlier, like it amazes me that Justin Trudeau even goes down this path and tries to attack Pierre Poilievre personally about his relationships with extremists or this, that, or the other, whatever they're dreaming up. When the opposition can just come back and go blackface and you're done. So why even go there when they've got way more on you than you've got on them?
What's the name of this group? The Diagle? What is it that they're talking about all the time now? I can't even think of the name now. It sounds like a character in Dungeons and Dragons or something. Diagalon, whatever. Most Canadians have never heard of this, have no idea what you're talking about. And I think the only reason that it's latched on to the Liberals is because, honestly, it sounds scary. It sounds like a Dungeons and Dragons name. It sounds like it's really like dark and horrendous. I don't think that if you asked 99.99999% of Canadians to explain what Diagalon, whatever the stupid thing is called, that they could tell you anything about it. Anything. And yet here we are in another rabbit hole of what are we doing here? What is this? Is this, is it bad? Is it not bad? Is it horrible? Is it mediocre?
Well,
who knows?
It's reactionary politics because they've spent 3 weeks on a budget they thought everybody was going to love and nobody does. And now they've got to change the channel on that. So, and again, I remember watching commentators just last week saying, you know what they got to do is they got to start attacking Poilievre because the budget's falling flat. And that's exactly what they're doing. But again, every time you attack somebody, they're just going to go into their tickle trunk of things like that and throw it back at you, which is exactly the breakdown we saw today. And it ended in a mess.
Yeah, it does, the whole thing, we would like to believe, I think, that the people who are being paid handsomely, Scott, to sit in the House of Commons are doing serious work for the benefit exclusively of the Canadian people. And yet, day after day, you realize, A, they're not, and B, this is entirely about seizing and keeping power more than anything else.
Yeah.
There's no way you can listen to these debates and discussions and fights and not say, wait, is this helping me as a tax-paying Canadian citizen, or is this just you trying to score points so you stay in power and you keep your big paycheck and you get your benefits and you get your MP pension? Who are we really fighting for here? And I heard nothing today that for 1 second was for the benefit of Canadians. Not 1 second benefited Canadians in this discussion.
Good point. Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Thank you, Scott. Have a great show.
Thank you, Mr. Non-Wacko.
All right. You're back at ya.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
As always, we leave it to you, the good listenership, and maybe wacko for the last word. Not in this case, though, from Mr. Lowe, teacher. Last week, Kiwis were priced at 89 cents each. Today, they're $1.49 each. Happy tax filing day. Oh, and my last word for the Toronto Maple Leafs. 4? Keep right, except to pass.